This is 55 Voices for Democracy, a production of the Thomas Mann House and the Los Angeles Review of Books. I'm Aida Baranejad.
And I'm Tom Zollner.
And today we are talking to a fellow of the Thomas Mann House, Ulrich Johannes Schneider, who served as the head of the Department of Research Projects and Research Planning at the Herzog August Bibliothek in Wolfenbüttel, Germany. Since 2004, he has been an adjunct professor of philosophy at the Institute for Cultural Studies of Leipzig University, and he has been a director of the Leipzig University Library from January 2006 through March 2022. Welcome to 55 Voices, Ulrich Schneider.
Hello. Great to be here.
Lovely to have you here. And our listeners can see it, but I'm seeing you on the Zoom screen, sitting in front of Thomas Mann's personal collection of books. So how have you been enjoying Thomas Mann's private library at the Thomas Mann House? What do you think about his collection of books and the way they are ordered there?
Well, it's not his historical collection of books, not the books which were there when he was here, but his own books are here now collected as a kind of a library for the fellows. And I'm reading Lotte in Weimar, actually. I never read this. This is Thomas Mann about Goethe, one famous writer about another famous writer, and the many people on whose admiration he depends. So it's fun to read.
Oh, yeah, I remember reading it, and it's indeed very fun. So I understand you're enjoying your time at the Thomas Mann House.
Yeah, it's not only this. I mean, this is recreation. I'm using the libraries quite a bit at USC, at the UCLA and Getty to boost up my research, which really depends a lot on American input. The American history of libraries is most interesting to me.
We tend to view libraries with a kind of a reverence, of course, those of us who love reading, those of us who are scholars, and so forth, and we put it on a rather high plane. And we tend to think of libraries as associated with democracy, the idea that anybody, whoever you are, can come on in and have access to the world's knowledge. Is that always the case, though?
It is in America. I don't know so much about the rest of the world, but going into a library, you come as you were with your set of minds, set of ideas, and then you do something which we call reading, or it's meeting other people, it's drinking coffee with somebody you know, and you change a little bit your mindset, and this can be called learning. And then you are, in a way, a changed person if you go outside. And we associate this kind of change which happens in a library with getting better judgment, being able to have more, let's say, grown-up ways of seeing things. And that could be associated with democracy or with living a democratic culture, dealing with differences and dealing with conflicts. I always like to remind people that the books in any library are really not saying the same thing. They are in dialogue or in conflict one with the other. There's a lot of debate going on, and if books could speak and if we could hear them, some would yell and there would be quite a loud noise in the library. And that's what you are confronted with if you go in a library. It's not peaceful there. It's action, it's movement in your mind, in your head. That's what I like about the libraries, but you are right that we love libraries nevertheless. We love them unconditionally. And there is a very positive, I would say, prejudice in favor of libraries, which I think historically can be looked into, has to be explained also because in our days, today, when our politicians think you can close down libraries because everything is online, you have to remind them that libraries are not only for books or media, they are for people.
I would like to dive deeper on that because, well, you just mentioned it, there is some push also in the public to understand libraries not as much as spaces with a monopoly on information, but rather as a third space where, as you said, we meet other people and engage in dialogue, they are made for people. But what makes libraries this ideal third space? And we do have cafes and restaurants, so why need libraries if we have other third spaces?
Well, I think it helps to look back at the 19th century when libraries really developed and there was a library building movement all over the world, not only in America, but very pronounced in America. At that time, published literature was becoming vast and endless. Not only books, but also newspapers and journals. Journals were kind of new in the 19th century and every profession had journals. And so there was a lot to read. And nobody could afford to buy all this. And libraries were invented to make it cost-free, the reading of published material, which at the bookshop you could pay for. So it was a kind of an exception of the rule. There was a knowledge society developing. Many members of that society could still afford to buy them. So professional associations of the architects, for example, they would have libraries where they had all the journals important for architects. But you as a citizen could go to a library, a well-equipped library in this case, and look up the journal for architects, architectural review, what have you, and you could read it for free. So that was an idea to create an extra space where knowledge was accessible for everybody. And that was not a nice idea. It was not something only philanthropic. And it was not only done with a lot of private money, like in the States it was, but it was done by taxpayers' money all over the world. So it was a necessity, really, to keep up the public on new published material. And if we then think about the library as something in between being at home, where you could also read, and being in an office, have your business life, as a third place in between those two, it's really open what a library can offer to you. If it's about knowledge, it can be anything. It can be also games, it can be entertaining things, and it shouldn't be limited to books.
You make me remember my time at the University of Arts here in Berlin, where I did my undergraduate degree. And even though YouTube was already invented, we all piled up in the university library on individual computers to watch these old movies that the collection of the university library had. So you brought up very happy memories of younger days of mine.
You talk about those limits on content. And, you know, we tend to think of libraries as a permanent repository that books written and shelved and cataloged are going to be there for decades, if not centuries. But that's not really the case, is it? I mean, libraries in some sense have to be just as ruthless as bookstores when it comes to culling material that is older and no longer referenced. And there's something sad about that, something kind of pathetic almost about a 15-year-old book that hasn't been checked out for a while. And so you have to then get rid of it. Can you talk about that process?
So when we talk about libraries, we think, especially in America, we think of public libraries, and all the discussion is about public libraries. Ever since 1876, when the American Library Association was founded and they had a journal about it, actually the public libraries, or what we call in German the öffentliche Bibliotheken, they are not there to collect for eternity. That's not their job. They have limited space and they have to change their collections to be up to date. That's what their readers want. And so I heard somebody saying that after 5 to 10 years, the collection of any given public library is 100% different. Maybe that's a little bit overdone, but I think it's basically true. You have other types of libraries, state libraries, national libraries, etc., and they collect. And they don't throw out books, not anymore, I guess. So it's a common business that libraries get rid of overstock and duplicates, etc., and in the case of public libraries, also of the not-so-current issues. Academic libraries tend to keep what some call a last copy, so that's a concern. It's a concern of space, but this concern is a bit diminished in our time, because now with digitization, space is not anymore a problem in libraries, not the traditional shelving space. So, for example, in Leipzig University Library, where I was director, I could build a cafe in the library building. I could build a conference room in the library building, just because I didn't need those spaces for shelving anymore, because digitization gets rid of all the journals. The journals were eating up all the space. You had to have empty shelves for the future, for the centuries to come, to house these journals. And now they are, in their current issues, they are digital, and also retrospectively they become digital. So that's it's a huge advantage now to think about what else you could do with these buildings and what you can build in there. Not all university libraries have cafes at this time, for example, but they have the place now to do so.
So why are spaces like cinemas, like cafes, like conference rooms so important to you for the library of the present and maybe the future?
My discovery, in a sense, was in 2017 when I was in Taiwan. And there was a library conference on library and society. And it was an international conference. What I didn't know was that international in those corners of the world means not having so much Europeans around. And they are quite international in their own right. And they were dealing with a situation which, in a way, they would call post-dictatorial societies. This is Taiwan, this is Korea, this is Malaysia, Singapore, etc. And now I could listen to them talking about new challenges for the libraries, which used to be institutions of the state, not much regarded. They were exercising censorship, etc. It was very much controlled what was accessible in the libraries. But now they're doing, for example, oral history. So they invite young people to interview elderly members of the community. What happened when the Japanese were there? What happened when Chiang Kai-shek had ruled the country? What happened in times which were, unlike ours now, less democratic to a degree? And I found this highly interesting because it also implied a collaboration between the national libraries, who provided the infrastructure, the hosting of the videotapes and files, and the public libraries, who organized locally the interviews and who have had young people meet older people. So that was something which I never heard of in Europe. And I know oral history is much more done in America. I like that very much. But it gave me the idea to think about functions, more direct functions of the library for the society they are working in there, they are there for. And this made me think then historically, because I have an historical mind, I always need to go back to understand where we are now. And so I discovered that in 1851 in Paris, there was the first library ever built with a reading room, a huge reading room for 400 people. And along with the reading room came toilets, restrooms, artificial lighting, and heating, which was unheard of. All of these things were unheard of because before, libraries were never built for people and their needs. They need to go to the restroom, they need artificial light, and certainly do need heating or cooling in other countries. So that was interesting. And then I found out that from that day on, from 1851, that was the Bibliothèque Saint-Geneviève in Paris, all the other libraries all over the world were built according to the same requirements. They all were catering now for people. They all built reading rooms. And in England and in America, you have reading rooms also in public libraries, which was not so much the case early on in the öffentliche Bibliothek in Germany. But the reading room is very important, and because it's now a room where officially, so to speak, structurally, people are welcome. Please sit here and stay as long as you like. And so it's a public place because ideally everybody can go in there. That's not entirely true, but basically it's true, or it became all the way through the time. There's a struggle to get real openness to libraries. But basically, this is a huge change in library history.
American librarians, some of them feel like they're under pressure like they've never experienced before from organized groups of parents who object to LGBTQ literature in those libraries. And, you know, the librarians, of course, feel as though, well, we're here for open source information, no matter what your ideological perspective. And, you know, it's really not up to us to make these decisions on behalf of our patrons. Do you, as the expression goes, have a dog in this fight?
We have also political discussions in Germany, what books should the library acquire and have. And is Hitler's Mein Kampf necessary and right-wing literature, etc. As it goes for public libraries, which are very important for younger people, adults, teenagers, etc., children and teenagers, the right of parents to intervene has to do with the idea that the library helps to educate and the library is part of the school system, which it is anyway. It's part of the process of learning. And the school is where you do most of the learning. And then you have school libraries. In America, you also and mostly have public libraries, which kind of complement what you learn at school. And then all these discussions about should the content of a library fit what you learn in school and fit the desires of the teachers and of the parents, that's a debate which is, let's say, which concerns half of the librarians all over the world. Should they cater for the needs of the schools and the parents, or should they just be representing what's out there, what's literature out there? And then again, if what's out there comprises books written in an anti-democratic way, etc., but books which are of an ideological nature, then even if you don't think libraries should educate, you still have the problem, should libraries represent everything which is published? Well, if you talk about national libraries and huge libraries, academic libraries, there's no problem there because they have membership users only who know how to deal with this material. But if you are open in the public, all I can say is I observe that discussion in America. It's very vivid, but it's not now new. It has been around also in the early 20th century, and it's then called the debate about the educational vocation of librarians. Some say, yes, we should do this, and we should engage with parents, and some say, no, we have a different agenda. So what I learned, for example, that there was the story hour in libraries. I don't know if they do it still, but it was introduced somewhere around 1900 when almost every library had a children's room as big as the adult reading room, the children's reading room. And then they had a special corner, and I find it amusing, often with a fireplace, often with a symbolic fireplace, wasn't really functioning, but it was suggesting that there is a homey atmosphere. Yeah, and all the children would assemble round a librarian who would then read a story. I mean, that's so far, my research tells me that's the case. I don't know, I don't have a list of what kind of stories they read. And I would love to be there and listen to the discussions they had afterwards, if they had discussions afterwards. So there is a debate, and this debate is very long, and it's very interesting. And I should think that every library, being differently located, having to do with different communities, should engage in that debate. That's the main thing. Libraries should engage. They shouldn't decide. They shouldn't possibly be authority or assume authority of some of these issues. But they should be should try to remain as open as possible, also in the intellectual sense, in the sense of keeping discussion going.
But the push Tom just mentioned to ban books on topics that are deemed unsavory for kids, doesn't that also have something to do with the desire of parents or of adults to control the horizon of knowledge for the younger generation, because that's the feeling I've had. And secondly, I wonder, is there a historical precedent for a free society to regress to banning books, which we as Germans have very traumatic and vivid historical memory of?
In America, the public library replaced the so-called social library. The social library in the 19th century was a gentleman's library of middle and high class people who had books. And the social library was where you assembled and discussed things. It was with a fireplace usually. And the public library was from the start upheld by taxpayers' money. And this was very important for all the librarians. It needed changes in the laws in order to establish this. So when Carnegie, the philanthropic billionaire in our times, he would have been a billionaire, wanted to give money to build public library buildings. He only gave money for the buildings. He sometimes had to wait till the states changed their law in order to allow libraries to be maintained. That was what Carnegie wanted them, by taxpayers' money. They didn't have the laws yet. So it is in England and in America, it is very, very clear that an institution upheld by taxpayers' money should be as open as possible and cannot cater to certain religious or other community needs. They can, I'm speaking as a kind of a out-of-touch historian, they can revert to the social library, have their own library with their own books if they want. If it's not taxpayers' money, they can do what they want. If it's taxpayers' money, you have an obligation to make it open for everybody, and you have an obligation, certainly, I think, not to discriminate anybody. In the States, there is this very complicated history of immigration and also of the black community. In library history, it is sad to see, for me as an historian, how long it took to have established libraries which accommodate both blacks and whites and others. That took quite some time. Any given society has problems in between the community, domestic problems, and they do not leave the library policies out there. They have relevance for that too. So all I can say is I try to observe this and to find out more about this. And of course, the German history is having had the fascists and also in the East German part, another kind of dictatorship with also very strict rules about what to read and what not to read. So I'm kind of alerted to this. But I have to accept that in other countries, it just works different ways. I try to focus on the door. I focus on the entrance door of a library, and I try to ask myself, who goes in there to do what, and who comes out there as what? So this is not really feasible. Many other library historians had said that we lack the sources. We don't have all the anecdotes. There's so many people going into the library, and everybody either starts like you and having fond memories of libraries and special stories about this, and everybody likes this very much, and I do like it, but I need it for the 19th and early 20th century, and how would I find this? So it's really difficult. But as a point of view, as a perspective on libraries, I think it's very important to do that. Not to speak on behalf and out of the perspective of the books, of the media, as many others do, but to focus on the social infrastructure the libraries belong to.
I'm reminded of the playwright August Wilson crediting the city of Pittsburgh and its open library to people of all races for the bulk of his education. He says he wouldn't have been a playwright had it not been for the library, to your point. I do want to ask, though, that was obviously a great mistake, a social mistake in the history of libraries to segregate them, and we're not making that mistake anymore. But from your perspective, what do you see as a mistake that library directors make, without naming names, of course, let's keep it general, But what do you see going on out there in terms of library policy with which you disagree?
I think that all over the world, the academic libraries should do more to reach out to a general public. In a way, academic libraries function like fortresses. They don't let anybody in, not in the administrative sense, but in the elitist intellectual sense. They say, well, this is for people who study. And I think we should open the discussions which are happening in academia also to the public. That's why I built a conference room in the library, because I said things should be talked about also touching the library there. The discussion should enter the library. And the cafe is even a more important thing, because in cafes, lots of discussion take place. And especially if the cafe is in the library, it tend to be used by readers. And this kind of function is very foreign to many library directors. They are very busy with all the regulations they have and all the little money they have and all the digitalization, which makes it really complicated to acquire books, to buy books, because you don't buy them, you license them, etc. So I know they have a lot to do with that. But I think in a democratic society, which is increasingly under threat and by people not believing in science, for example, we should do more to be an advocate of science and make science more accessible. So as the public libraries, they lend not only books, but games and video games and VR glasses, etc., and try to extend their attractivity, be more attractive to young users. I think the academic libraries here and elsewhere should also try to translate, to help to translate what science is all about in a way. Well, the easiest way is to have a discussion about this, to have a public event about this. What I like, if I may add, about the American public library is that the usual thing they built out in the country, in the Midwest, and in very small communities, the smallest community should have had in Carnegie's plan 1,000 inhabitants, so it's really small. But then he would finance a library which always had two floors, a basement and a first floor. And in the basement, always, there was a lecture hall. So that's very, very endearing to me, to from the start not have the facilities down there, the restrooms and the heating system, but also a lecture hall. And that's something which is indicative of the mission the library can have in inviting more people in, because the lecture hall can be filled also by people who are not patrons of the library. So to be open in that sense, library business is about realizing openness in all ways you can.
I used to live until quite recently in the district of Friedrichshain-Kreuzberg in Berlin, and the Stadtrat, the commissioner for libraries in this district, wanted to also open the library. She bought a library bicycle, which is a mobile library that goes out to parks in the summer where you can sit next to it and get books in the middle of the park. They started cookie and coffee meeting dates at the library, and they also moved towards the Library of Things, which I think is a very interesting concept to me, not only lending media as such as books, films, games, but also, as you mentioned, VR goggles or even sewing machines and gaming consoles. But this has been criticized quite heavily by other political actors in Berlin. So what do you answer to those criticizing moving towards libraries that offer more than books and maybe music and films?
Thank you for this question. Let me take the bicycle aspect of it. What I learned in reading about library history in the States is something entirely new to me, which is the traveling library. The traveling library was invented in the 19th century, and it was basically a box for 100 volumes. And it was sent out to very, very small communities, was sitting there in the drugstore, in the post office or somewhere. And half a year later, it was sent back to whoever sent it and was exchanged with another traveling library. And the traveling library was a private initiative of so-called club women in America, and was done in the countryside and was meant for rural America, where there was no access to any big city, and the big city was far away, etc. So it started already in the second half of the 19th century. But for example, when the famous librarian Melville Dewey became director of the State Library in New York, he introduced that system in 1893, and it was hugely successful. So he had to increase the boxes, the traveling libraries. He started out with 100, and 3 years later, he had 350 in circulation. So this outsending of books, outgoing of books, and as you rightly mentioned, not only of books, but of other material, that could be very well an idea for a library, not only inviting them in the one building they have, but also catering in a very literal sense to people out there. If you go to UCLA campus here, there are little robots going around distributing coffee and sandwiches. You could have those robots going anywhere to, or drones, whatever, to deliver books, etc., from a library, not only from Amazon or some commercial dealer. Yeah, so I like this idea, but it's I know in Germany it's an unheard of idea, and the building idea is very strong in Germany, as it is, by the way, in America too. So the main building of the central library is usually a monumental artifice. It's really impressive, and it should be impressive. That's meant to be. It's in somewhere in the cultural center of town, not directly in the commercial center. And so that's very... But in the early 20th century, they started to build branch libraries. Imagine that New York didn't have erected its... The big New York Public Library was finished in 1911. But before that, 1904, they started planning branch libraries, 65 of them, 65 in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, etc. That was quite a lot, and it was quite difficult to do because, I mean, there were houses already everywhere, and it was difficult to negotiate where. So they made it a business. They had a manager to find those places to make the library locally accessible. So the local aspect is, I think, very, very important.
I should have disclosed earlier that this side of the broadcast is coming from within a library, that is the Baker Library at Dartmouth College. So in that way, it's appropriate. And this has been a tremendous discussion. And perhaps in closing, as a way to think about it, I'd like to ask you to react to a thought from the Argentinian novelist Jorge Luis Borges, who famously said, you probably know the quote that's coming, that he always had imagined paradise as a kind of a library. How do you react to that?
That's absolutely true. It's a kind of a paradise. I mean, you should put paradise in the plural. There are many paradises. Pacific Palisades and the Thomas Mann House is a paradise for me. But when I go to the Doheny Library this afternoon, I am in a different sort of paradise. I go through the stacks, look for books, then I sit in this vast reading room, and I feel like a student again. And that's very uplifting. That's very nice. And I see the other people who are much younger than I am, and they're doing stuff which will change their life, their world. And this is also very, very nice to watch other people in the library and to think about them and what they may become.
Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. And now I immediately want to go visit a library, which is, I guess, the best outcome for a conversation with a librarian. Thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you, Ulrich.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to 55 Voices for Democracy, a production of the Thomas Mann House and the Los Angeles Review of Books, in collaboration with our partners Goethe Institute Boston, Goethe Pop-Ups in Seattle, Houston, and Kansas City, and Wunderbar Together. produced and edited by Lisa Bartfall. Don't forget to like, subscribe, leave a review, and tell your friends.